Aloha, friends. Welcome back to 50 Tastes of Grey, where I try to serve up a delectable dish of tasty banter each and every episode. I'm your host, Matthew Grey, and boy, do we have a treat for you today. But first, let me take you back to a moment when I was feeling a bit down in the dumps, kind of lost in that post-pandemic blues that I think has captured everyone's attention. Suddenly, like a bolt of lightning, I stumbled upon the comedic genius of Brian Kiley, a master of the one-liner and a former comedy writer behind the scenes of Conan O'Brien's late-night show. I really enjoyed myself. It took me away from all my troubles. So fast forward to today, I'm thrilled to have Brian join me on today's show. We hit it off like two peas in a pod, bonding over our East Coast roots and sharing hearty chuckles about everything under the sun, from family foibles to the hilarity of stage fright. And let me tell you, folks, our banter was so good that I just had to share it with you. So what I want to do is I'd like to thank the people over at Dry Bar Comedy. They were able to give me some exclusive clips of Brian's side-splitting stand-up, so I was able to sprinkle that into the conversation today. You can catch the full experience on my 50 Tastes of Grey YouTube channel or over at lovelife.com, my online home, for the audio version. And the aficionados amongst you who just like to listen and not watch. And hey, if you're enjoying this vibe, don't forget to hit the like, give us a follow, and subscribe for more laughter-filled content. You know, that kind of stuff really definitely helps out those of us who are trying to prepare content for you. So without further ado, grab your popcorn and get ready to bust a gut as we dive into a side-splitting session with the one and only Brian Kiley. Trust me, folks, you won't want to miss a single moment of this comedic feast. Enjoy. Welcome aboard, my friend. It's so nice to meet you face-to-face.
Yes, you too.
And I see that we're in the kitchen studio over in the...
My wife's an amazing woman. She knows a lot about wine. Like, she knows which wine goes with which breakfast cereal. Very impressive.
That's the way I would have it no other way. Since you're in the kitchen, I might as well start the show by asking you, what have you eaten today?
Oh, seriously? Okay. So a bowl of cereal, and I can only have decaf because I get migraines. So I had a bowl of cereal, a cup of decaf, and then I did some writing. And then before I exercised, I had some oatmeal. I've been in a bad habit of having like peanut butter on English muffin every day. So I'm trying to kind of veer away from that a little bit.
So I live in LA now. I like LA. It's a strange place. On Halloween, I frightened all my neighbors. I dressed up as gluten.
And then at about 11:45, I had some tuna on some Ritz crackers.
So what makes you think that there's a connection between caffeine and migraines?
Well, the irony is there are times when I would get a migraine and they would give me a caffeine pill. So it's somehow the cause and the cure. But that it turned out caffeine's one of my triggers. I can't have chocolate. I always joke that, you know, I can't have red wine. There are certain sort of processed food meats I can't have. I always joke, what trigger is it that could be a fond memory? And it doesn't take much. But I'm aware of my triggers now, and I'm pretty good. And also, if I sense one coming on, I'll take half a pill, and that usually keeps it in check. If I miss my window and it's a full-blown migraine, then it's over. And it's like the day's ruined. But I've been pretty good the last few years of knowing when it's coming on and taking preventative measures.
So when you speak of triggers, you're speaking almost entirely about migraine-related triggers.
Yes. And absolutely. And, you know, stress is a big part of this. I have to say, since, you know, I don't have a writing job at the moment, so I've had fewer migraines, I hate to say it, as much as I'd like to get back in the writer's room.
I'm kidding, of course. My wife is the best thing that ever happened to me. And I say that because when I met my wife, I only had like 2 minutes of material. She's really come through for me.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we would gladly take a few more migraines for a few more bucks.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. I'll trade that. Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, well, you know, the fact that you cannot have chocolate is a bummer. Why isn't it like, you know, lamb's testicles is your biggest trigger? And like, you don't want to eat that because you don't want a migraine, you know? It has to be something delicious.
I know. I know. It's, yeah, absolutely. It's not saltines. It's not, you know, it's, you know, yeah.
Well.
So I'm from Boston originally, but I live in Los Angeles now, and things shut down there around March of 2020. So I haven't been to the gym since 1989. I'm going to get back out there.
What part of the world are you in right now, Brian?
Right now, I live in Los Angeles. So I'm originally from the Boston area, but I live in Los Angeles now. Yeah, and I lived in New York for a bunch of years, but I still feel like I'm a Bostonian at heart in some ways.
My wife told me today that my daughter's been shoplifting. So now I have to deal with that. I'm going to wait until after my birthday.
Oh, well, here, I'll make you feel comfortable. Clam box. Is that even close to Bostonia? Probably not.
Not bad, not bad.
Do you miss the seafood from the East Coast?
I do, I do. I love a good clam chowder, and I love a lobster roll in the summer. Oh, so delicious.
I tried making lobster rolls for the holidays, and it's just not the same when you try to do it in your own kitchen on the East Coast.
Yeah, that's a brave move, but good. You know, I applaud your effort.
Thank you. And what part of LA are you from? Because that's where I used to live for a long time as well.
Oh, okay. So I live in Studio City.
Oh, yeah, that's where I was. I was up on Vineland, up south of the Boulevard.
Oh, nice. Yeah. So we live the corner of Moore Park and Laurel Canyon.
Wow.
I'm like 2 blocks from there. Yeah.
Okay. So at least you have a good supermarket nearby. Isn't there Gelson's right there?
Yes, there's a Gelson's, there's a Vaughn's, and I can also, what I love about my neighborhood, we can actually walk, I can walk to places, to restaurants or CBS or whatever, Barnes & Noble, so on. It's in your car all the time in LA, so it's actually nice when there's things that are walking distance, you know?
Yeah, that's a nice part of the San Fernando Valley, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's good,
yeah.
It's good to be able to walk to a nearby place where you could start doing your looting with all the other people in LA.
Yes, I actually do looting Tuesdays and Thursdays. I find it kind of works in my schedule.
I think that's a good way to kind of balance it out.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, people don't realize what an aerobic activity looting is.
You cracked the fuck up out of me. I just recently found you zipping around on YouTube, and I think it was called, let's give them an appropriate plug. Was it Dry Bar Comedy Show?
Yes, it was the Dry Bar Comedy .com. So this is interesting. So it's in Utah.
Uh-huh.
And it's, we shot it, I guess they shoot in Provo, as I recall. And it's a bar with no alcohol.
Wow.
And the show, it's interesting because whenever I'd done television, whether it was Conan or Letterman or The Tonight Show or whatever, I always work TV clean, and I've always kind of geared my act to that because I wanted as a kid I wanted to be on Johnny Carson, so I really worked my act to be so that I could go on television, and I was able to do that, and I wasn't able to I didn't make it on terms with Johnny, but I got on the other shows, but this was an extra challenge because you couldn't say the word sex, so there were jokes that you go well. And a late night spot, you're getting on at midnight and whatever, and it can't be filthy, but it can be a little whatever. I mean, you can have adult themes or whatever. And this was like, no. And the other thing which the hardest thing was, I usually don't swear on stage, but if I swear on stage, I'm aware of it. It's like, oh, something slipped out or whatever. But with this, like you couldn't say, oh my God. And that's the kind of thing I would say that without knowing that I said it. You know, I would just say it and not even realize, hey, you're not supposed to say that, where it's like, Oh, really? Don't people say, oh my God? I don't know. So there was sort of interesting parameters, and I'm almost never in a situation where I have to edit stuff out. Uh-huh. You know, and usually the other acts I'm working on are usually much dirtier than me. And I also get in a situation where I could follow the filthiest guy. So it's the filthiest act and he kills. And then if I go on and say something slightly risque, the crowd's like, hey, come on, cut that out. There's no need for that. Oh,
I've been a little depressed. You know, we didn't see my wife's family for Easter. We didn't see them for Christmas. And I've been a little depressed because I know at some point we're going to have to see them again.
And it's like, what? That guy was filthy. You know, and you love him.
Is that maybe a reputational thing, or is it based on your appearance and people just don't expect it out of you? Or what is it?
Yes, I think it's all those things. And I think, you know, especially now, sometimes the crowds are very young and it's like I'm their dad. And they're like, hey, we don't want to hear dick jokes out from our dad. So, yeah. So that's, but I'm always amazed where it's like, hey, the other guy, I was blushing in the back when the other guy was on. Give me a break, you know?
Right. Since you spent your almost entire career up to this point working so clean, do you need to maybe get it out of your system? Do you want to let loose for a moment here?
Yes.
LA is a strange place. When the pandemic started, I drove by the park in my neighborhood and I spotted a guy sunbathing naked. I yelled, hey, buddy, put a mask on.
And just spew profanities for a few minutes, that would be great. You know, it's funny. I wrote a novel about 10 or 12 years ago, and it's very dirty and it's very dark. And it was very liberating for me because, you know, I worked in television for so long and you have all these restraints and they just become part of you. But it was so nice to throw that away and just not censor myself. And it was very actually liberating to kind of go to dark and dirty places for once, you know?
My wife's always shocked when I actually know something. Like the other night we're watching Jeopardy. And the question is, what's the tallest building in the world? And I said, oh, that's Burj Khalifa in Dubai. She's like, how do you know that? I said, well, when your parents are living with us, I Googled, what should I jump off of? And that's what came up.
Was that a premeditated effort on your part, or was it?
No, what happened was I was taking a class, and I thought I wrote a short story. And the teacher said, well, that's not a short story. That's the first chapter of a novel. So the next week I'd bring in the next chapter. And I had no idea. I mean, I was an English major and I loved to read, but I didn't really know. I had an idea where it was going to end up, but I really didn't know how I was going to get there. So every day, so every week I'd write a new chapter. And then this was when the whole thing with the Tonight Show went down with Conan and Leno and so on. So we got knocked off the air. So now I'm suddenly out of work. So I wanted to kind of use that time and not just sit around the house. So I would get up every day and shower and shave, and I'd go in the other room and I would sit and write for like 3 hours, and I wouldn't know where I was. I would come out of there and go, okay, that was really dark. And some stuff I'm like, I don't know where that came from, but that was, you know, I did that every day for a few months. Yeah.
Well, what's the name of that book that you wrote, the really dark, nasty one? I want to get a copy.
It's called The Astounding Misadventures of Rory Collins.
Ah. And so how did that end up doing?
It actually did okay. You know, I sold a couple thousand copies, and I had somebody who wanted to turn it into a movie, but the offer was so low. I was like, I was holding out for more. So maybe that was foolish on my part, but at the same time, it was... I don't want to say insulting, but it was kind of like, it's like, you know, that's not worth it to give it away if someone else down the road wants to actually make it into something, you know?
When I was growing up, the guy across the street from us was actually in the mafia. and he was a very nice guy. He used to pay me $10 every morning just to start his car. What a guy.
We've got our pride after all.
Yes, yes, yes. That was the last little ounce of pride I had, I used on that.
Well, that's wild. I want to circle back a little bit and let people know a little bit about your background as a writer is it Conan O'Brien for over 19 years?
I wrote for Conan for 27 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So I started 6 months in and then I went through the whole run. And then after Conan ended, I jumped on the last season of Ellen. And then I did that it was only on that last year. So for 28 years, and now I'm not having a writer's room, not having, I'm such a creature of habit. I'm hoping, hope somebody hires me again someday.
Do you think that the whole late night thing has seen its day and is?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah. I hate to say it because I don't want to be like, well, it was good for me. And now it's, but I do know the ratings on all these shows have really gone down. And, it started probably 20 years ago where I think the internet heard it. I think also in the old days, there was nothing else on after 11:30 or whatever.
Right.
Now you can go to your Netflix queue or your Hulu or Max or whatever and watch. You can binge watch your shows. You don't need to watch that kind of thing. So I do, I'm curious if it's just not going to be worth, that model's not going to be worthwhile if the ratings keep dropping,
Yeah. And I think that we were talking earlier before the show, we were talking about just like, it's here to stay. And we were referring to the technology. It appears as though the outrageous and mind-numbing number of choices that are out there is also yes. here to stay and to increase.
Yes, absolutely. And we live in such a niche world. And that was actually a problem we would have with Conan sometimes because, when I was a kid, there were three networks and even you knew who all the TV stars were. Even if it was a show that you didn't watch, you knew who they were. And I can't imagine if you're an impressionist, if you're a comedian and you do impressions, half the people aren't going to know who you're talking about. We live in such a fractured society now, unless you're doing Trump or there's so few people that are known across the board,
Do you have a friend you've known a long time tell you something that just blows your mind? Today, my best friend, who I've known my whole life, revealed to me that he's imaginary. I didn't see that coming.
That's true. When you were working for Conan, was it tough being one of his writers? I'm not speaking about the aspect of being, gainfully employed. I'm just speaking about the feeling of writing for a super duper celebrity like that. So I'm wondering if you were writing for his personality or were you writing your own stuff and just hoping he says, I really dig what Brian wrote here and there and there. I'll use this and that more so than you writing for his style.
I was back in New England about 5 years ago. I went to one of those corn mazes, one of those giant corn mazes. I couldn't find my way out. I'm wandering around for like 2 hours. Finally, I took off all my clothes. Because if you're naked, security will come. Security came, they got lost. They took off all their clothes. We were there for days.
Well, you do, I did have to, you do have to, whatever the host is, or it's the same thing, you have to learn the voice of the person, And the same thing if you were writing for a character in a sitcom or something. Luckily, with Conan and me, there's a lot of overlap because we're two repressed Irish Catholic guys from the Boston area. So we had a lot in common. Although I will say this, before I started, I loved a good wordplay joke. And he doesn't like those. So there was a joke one time when I was first there. There was a story about some woman had a baby on the subway and they wrapped the baby in the Sunday New York Times. And I said a joke, coincidentally, it was the C-section. And I thought it was a clever little joke. No, he wow. crossed it up. That was corny. That was whatever. And I was kind of shocked where jokes like that, that I thought were clever, he found corny. So I used to do a lot of wordplay in my act 30 years. I had to really cut that stuff out because that was something he didn't like, you know.
Oh, that's so funny. He's so corny that you think that a corny gig or corny.
Yes, it's funny because, and he would contradict himself in the sense that every once in a while would have one that was so corny, he would actually do it to kind of make fun of it. Do you know what right. I mean? Right. So there was that sort of irony. But you do, you know, it's funny. We had a writer who, that's the other thing about when you work on these shows, you've got to tailor what you're writing to what the boss likes. And it's the same on Ellen. It's the same on all those shows. And we had a guy who would write very funny stuff. And Conan would say, that's a funny bit, but let's have it like this. And he'd be like, nope, it's like this. It's like, well, that's not how it works. You know, it's not your show. It's his show. And he wants it that way. And luckily, I mean, I will say 90% of the time he was right. He'd tweak something and he would make it better. And there were sometimes he would have a joke that was pretty good and he would make an adjustment. And it was like, oh, you know what? That's a good joke now that he tweaked it. And once in a while, it was like, oh, I liked it better before, you know. Yeah. But that is a thing of, I'm sure it's the same thing on a sitcom, who's that, whether it's the showrunner or whatever, you've got to adjust to them. They don't adjust to you. You have to just adjust to them.
Bought a box of animal crackers. It said, do not eat if seal is broken. I open it up. Sure enough. The giraffe was fine. All right, now who didn't get that?
Right. Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears as though, you know, folks of a certain age, let's say you and I, we're sure. familiar with a lot of well-known comedians who were late-night hosts, not necessarily comedians working the circuit. I can't really think of a lot of those guys, except for Leno, who worked the circuit, did stand up throughout the year. Can you?
I think Fallon did some stand-up before he got on SNL, although I never got to see him. And I think he also, I think he did a lot of, as you would, no surprise, he's so talented musically. I think he did a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Although I never got to see him do stand-up. David Letterman did in the old days. You know, we would see him go on The Tonight Show as a stand-up and so on. But I've never got to see him in a club or anything like that.
Right. Everyone's shtick and bits were kind of made for the, you know, the 6-minute segment on talk shows, not going out on the road and doing it.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. And I know that he had worked in the Comedy Store and all those places back in the old days, but that was, you know, before my time. But, you know, Jay is still out there and he's out there a machine, you know, he burns his face and then he's back on stage a couple of days later. It's like, it's kind of, it's really unbelievable, you know?
Yeah. He's a beast.
Incredible. Yeah. He really is. Yeah.
And I think he gets that kind of respect from people in the business because he's able to do it over and over for years on end.
And I remember the old days when I was in college, when he was on Letterman, that was a treat. You know, yeah. he was on like 4 or 5 times a year and the two of them were so funny together. That was kind of must-see TV whenever Jay was on Letterman, you know?
Right. As far as your comedic inspiration, where do you draw that upon? Is that personal experiences, current events, or something else entirely? Is it coming from within somewhere? Do you have a wellspring of funny stuff happening?
Well, I think I wish my life were more interesting. But you know, when I was working at Conan, you really had to focus on the news every day and that kind of thing. my act is sort of just satirizing my life and just sort of the everyday stuff with my life, whether it's stuff with my kids or my wife or, you know, going to the doctor or the dentist or what, you know, the little sort of minutiae. So I guess I sort of try to satirize my everyday life, I would say.
So my wife and I, we recently celebrated our 29th wedding anniversary. Oh, thanks. Thanks very much. Thank you. And I'm happily married. I know that I'm lucky because 50% of married people say they're unhappily married. This is according to a poll I took earlier today at my house. What's her problem?
Right. Your style is one-liner. So yeah. That's something that was big back in the day, but hasn't been for a long time. And I think it's also part of what makes you so outstanding.
Oh, well, thanks. You know, when I first started, I would try to do bits. I even tried to do impressions. I was a horrible impressionist. I'm jealous of guys that can come out and tell a 10-minute story that gets laughs all the way through. The good thing about doing one-liners was if I was doing a Letterman spot or something like that, I could go out there and get 18 punchlines or 20 punchlines in 5 minutes.
My wife told me today that my daughter's been shoplifting. So now I have to deal with that. I'm going to wait until after my birthday.
You know, the hard thing is if you have to go out and do an hour, you go, I got to do 180 jokes, you know, and do people want to sit through 180 jokes, you know, that makes it that much harder. You know, when I did a Comedy Central special in 2006, they had a teleprompter. So I put off my bullet points. I had 97 jokes and they said, well, that's a record.
Yeah, I bet.
But, you know, that is a thing of, it wasn't a conscious thing. I would write jokes as a kid and I loved jokes. If I could go out there and tell stories or do impressions or do these other things, I would. It's almost, it's like, well, I don't know how to do that. So you just have to do what you do, you know?
Teenagers are the worst. The other day, my little girl talked back to my wife. My wife told her to do something. She said, no, I don't want to. I had to pull her aside and say, listen, you got to teach me how to do that.
Is your style of one-liners a reflection of the way that you think or the way that you absorb life versus the guy who does tell the 10 or 15-minute stories?
Yes, Yeah. I mean, I think I've always kind of, I guess I think in these little bursts as opposed to, you know, one of the things that amazed me when I started at Conan, he would go on these giant riffs and build things and keep going and be funny for 5 minutes all the way through off the cuff. And I was like, what is this? You know, and he would kind of create these images and kind of keep going. And whereas I would just kind of jump in with a joke and then jump back out.
Right, right. When you have something that's happening in your world, do you think to yourself, this will make a great joke, and you're able to somehow reduce this experience that was maybe 2 hours long down to 25 seconds?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's definitely things that I'll see, and even some things where I'll see and think, I don't know what the joke is yet, but that is a good area, and there's something there that I can play with and satirize and whatever, you know? But yeah, we actually... It's funny because mostly on the show, I worked on the monologue, but there were times we would write sketches and work on other things. And there was going to do an LA version of that zombie show, The Walking Dead. They were going to have a LA version of it. So we had this bit where we had people get the zombie makeup on and they're rollerblading and they're selling oranges by the side of the road, doing all these things. And it got cut down to a 2-second thing of a zombie in traffic in his car, just banging his head against the steering wheel. And it was like, oh my God, we shot for 8 hours. Those people took 2 hours to put the makeup on. And that was the only clip that they took.
And they took all the LA out of that clip.
Yep, except for the traffic. So it was just like, okay, that was it, you know?
I saw someone hitchhiking the other day. Hitchhiking. It's so dangerous. I came this close to pulling over and murdering him myself. Just to teach him a lesson.
So, and that actually is one thing. I mean, brevity is the soul of wit, and there are times where, and even I find that with sitcoms where they've got the 22 minutes down. And sometimes they say, oh, we're going to have an hour special or a 40-minute episode or whatever. It's like, that doesn't make it funnier, you know? And I think a lot of comedy movies, an hour and a half is great. And when it goes on for 2 hours or 20 minutes, it's like, you kind of watered it down, you know?
Right, right. Becomes a little bit painful at a certain point.
Yeah. It's like, it was funny up to here. And that's when you get out, you know?
My aunt retired this week. She worked at the DMV for 40 years. 40 years at the DMV. And in that time, she waited on nearly a dozen customers. Isn't that something?
Early on in your life, were you the funny kid in life who always was cracking jokes, or did you want to be a comedy writer for another, or were you doing stand-up prior to writing?
I was doing stand-up prior to writing. But yeah, as a kid, the highlight of my day was if I got a laugh and made the class laugh. And I was pretty good at being able to make the teacher laugh also, which was key, you know. But that was the highlight of the day for me. You know, my younger brother went to Harvard, and he was the smart one. And I'm sure the highlight for him was knowing the answer that no one else knew or whatever. But for me, it was getting the big laugh in class, you know.
Beyond the embarrassment that us regular mere mortals feel from time to time, what is it like as a comedian if you're bombing? If for whatever reason jokes aren't landing, people aren't laughing, how uncomfortable is that feeling, and how do you get over that?
Oh yeah. I mean, it really is that thing. If you fail, you're really publicly humiliated, you know? And there's a couple different scenarios, because sometimes what happens is you get booked somewhere where it's like an office Christmas party and they don't want a comedian. They're mingling, they're having their drinks, they're having a great time, and they go, okay, we're going to bring out a comedian, where they're like, boo, we don't want that. Do you know what I mean? Right. So there are those situations where, go on, there's a din of noise, no one's paying attention, and you bomb. And that's, yeah, obviously it's terrible. But those situations, I'm kind of like, well, the situation was terrible more than, you know, those situations, I think, I don't know that the Jerry Seinfeld would do well in this situation, because if they're not listening, you know, you might as well be at a bus terminal or something.
My wife does this thing. Every time we watch a movie together, she falls asleep in the first 5 minutes. Every time. She doesn't even know I'm here tonight. She thinks the two of us are watching The Shawshank Redemption.
Those experiences, which I have, aren't as painful to me as when you go out. It's an audience. They're all listening. You could hear a pin drop, and you're bombing, where you go, well, I can't put this on. I can't say, well, this is the circumstances or whatever. That's all on me, you know?
Isn't that weird? Because like last week, all this stuff worked, and now it's not.
Oh, there are shows. I mean, there's a club here where they have an early show and a late show. And the early show is often packed. We all do great. And then the second show, an hour later, there's 20 people there. It's terrible. We all bomb with the exact same material. And you want to say, hey, folks, 90 minutes ago, this stuff killed in this very room, you know?
Right, right. Maybe you need to videotape it when it's working and then just show it to the people who aren't laughing at you now.
Yeah, see? It's not me. It's you. Look at this.
Right, exactly.
I was talking to my other friends. He said to me, if you had a time machine, would you go back in time and kill baby Hitler? Here's the thing. I'm a dad. I don't think I could kill a baby. But I could strangle teenage Hitler.
What a way to ingratiate yourself with the audience.
Right? Sure. But that is the thing of you do a joke the first show, it gets a round of applause. You do it the second show and they stare at you like, why would you say something like that? And you're like, well, because the other crowd applauded. I don't know what to tell you, you know?
So it's really, there's no way to really know which way the wind blows when it comes to
comedy. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, hopefully as you get better, you're working in better venues and that happens less. It's kind of like you're a boxer and every once in a while you're going to get knocked out.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
So how often are you going to the clubs these days?
Well, now, one Saturday during the pandemic, it was the little girl next door's birthday, and she couldn't have a birthday party, so all of her friends drove by her house and beeped and waved and wished her a happy birthday. And it brought a tear to my eye because that's how my parents used to celebrate my birthday. So glad their tradition continues.
I'm actually doing a lot these days because, you know, I don't have a job at the moment. So I'm doing a lot of shows. I'm kind of putting my act first these days as opposed to putting the show I'm working on first. So right. I'm enjoying working on my act. And, you know, I'm very spoiled in that I get to hang out with such funny people all the time. And when I was in the writer's room for Conan and Ellen and hang out with the, you know, the comedians in Boston were hilarious. And then I went to New York and they're hilarious in LA. So I've just gotten to hang out with such funny people for so long. I just love that. And I love being in the green room with other comics. I love being in the writer's room, all that stuff. So there's a ton of funny stand-ups out there, you know?
Yeah.
My daughter graduated from college during the pandemic and her graduation took place online. And she was so bummed out about it. Here's the thing. She went to an online university. I don't know what she's expecting, to be honest.
It seems like Bill Burr has exploded over the last few years. Is he somebody that you admire personally or professionally?
Yes, I have. And so Bill started out a couple of years after me in Boston. So we did a lot of shows together in the old days. And it's been a fascinating journey for me to watch Bill because, first of all, he always killed right from the get-go. You know, most of us take, there's a learning curve, whatever. No, when he started, he was this redheaded, innocent. His comedy was very gentle. And just to see the progression, he killed the whole time. It's just interesting. His style now, he's become this sort of grizzled, you know, cynical veteran guy. Where that was, if you saw him 30 years ago, it's like a different person, you know?
Is that right?
Yes. So it's actually quite remarkable that he was able to transform himself in the way he has and not miss a beat, you know?
Do you think, in your personal opinion, that his angry in your face style is something that's more shtick than it is reality?
You know, he's a great guy. And, he, you know, you don't meet him and go, oh, that guy, you know, whatever. Like, I enjoy talking to Bill. He's a great guy. And he's a very good-hearted person. And so I will say it's shtick. I mean, that's sort of the comedic part of him, you know. And yeah. I think that we all strive to find the funniest part of ourselves and put that out there, you know. If you're a silly comedian, you're not going to be silly your whole life. So right. I don't think he walks around the world angry, but I think that's probably figured out that that's the funniest part of him, you know?
Yeah.
You have to be ready for anything when you have kids. One time my son was 4 years old. We came back from the drugstore at the mall. He pulls a candy bar out of his pocket. Now, I didn't buy him a candy bar. I knew he didn't pay for it. So we jump back in the car. We drive back to the mall. And this time, we went to a jewelry store. You got to strike while the iron's hot. That's what I say.
Yeah, I think he's pretty good. And so I'm just wondering if there's a reason why female comedians never really hit it. Is it a cultural thing? Is it a gender thing, or can you explain that at all?
When I was a kid, I knew of Toni Fields, but I don't remember ever seeing her. I would see Joan Rivers. And, you know, when I was 9 and 10 years old, I didn't know who she was talking about. you know, if she's talking about Elizabeth Taylor or Richard Burton or whoever she's doing drugs with, I didn't know who those people were. Do you know what I mean? And I remember Phyllis Diller, and I remember thinking Phyllis Diller was funny. But I do think now there are a ton of really funny female comics out here.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, I mean, I think a huge part of, we're a sexist society that is less sexist now. And if you, I know she wasn't a stand-up, but if you look at Lucille Ball, I mean, she really was the queen of the sitcom, you know, and still is, you know. And I think now people are a little sort of less threatened by a funny woman or something like that. I love it when a woman is funny. And, you know, I find it very attractive. And but I think some guys want to be the funny one or whatever, you know.
Sure.
But I love it when a woman makes me laugh. And I have to say, I think when I started, a lot of women have crowds could give a woman a really hard time. And they had to deal with maybe more heckling or more, you know, and even sometimes if there's an attractive woman on stage, they would get sort of negative response from other women in the crowd. Uh-huh. So I think that would happen too sometimes. I think women like Gilda Radner was so funny on SNL.
Yeah.
And I think that helped pave the way for Tina Fey and Kate McKinnon and these other people, you know. I don't know. I think there's a ton of funny women out now, and I think people are more accepting of that.
I call my wife Pumpkin because she always gets smashed around the holidays.
And not like... It.
Yeah. How much of your commentary on life is really designed to spark thought about social issues or relationships or things like that, or is it just all different types of styles?
I know some comics have sort of an agenda in a way.
Yeah.
I've actually tried to avoid that as much as I can be. And I find the same way in shows. I love when a show is just funny. That makes, and not to say that there are some things you don't want to be, you don't want to be picking on, you don't want to be punching down, I guess, is what I'm saying. And when I see preachy comics or preachy sitcoms, that kind of repulses me, you know? And there are comics I'll see, political comics I'll see, and I agree with everything they're saying, but they don't make me laugh. Yeah.
Do you ever get nervous before going out and performing? Do you ever have that kind of shock that people talk about getting up in front of others?
There was no one more nervous than me for years when I started. I used just to be terrified. I would have a knot in my stomach, all that stuff. And then as you just do it a lot, that goes away eventually. But also what would happen to me is if I was doing Letterman the next day, at some point I would become completely terrified. And I would have this period of, I would maybe wake up in the middle of the night, go, what am I doing? These jokes aren't going to work. I'm going to bomb. Why am I in this situation? You know, I got to get out of this, you know, whatever. I've learned it. It's almost like the stages of grief. And I learned to go, okay, you know what? This is the part where I get terrified and it's going to go away. I'll be okay. But this is just part of the process. And it would happen every time. And it might happen the night before. It might happen in the car on the way over. But at some point would be completely terrified and think, what am I doing? Why I'm going to bomb on television. This is going to be terrible. I learned that was just one of the steps. And then I just go, okay, this is the part, you know, in a few minutes, I'll be fine. This is just one of the phases, you know.
But I still miss the way things were before the pandemic, right? When things were normal. I was back in Boston a couple years ago. I visited my childhood home. And I knocked on the door and I said, excuse me, I used to live here. Can I look around? And reluctantly, my parents let me in. What's their problem?
So you were experiencing the stage fright, you were experiencing the fear, but you never were a no-show, right? You never just said,
No. I would do it. And I, you know, they would both, these shows, they would often put me on at the last minute if somebody canceled. And say, you know, we're going to have you be the sort of the emergency guy. It's almost like you're in AAA and the Major League Baseball team calls you up. But we need a starter today, you know, that kind of thing. And I know I had friends who would say no. They'd say, hey, can you come and do the Tonight Show today or tomorrow? And they go, oh, no, I need more notice. And to me, it's like, this is what we've been waiting our whole lives for. You can't say no. You might not get another chance. So, yes, if, you know, can you imagine if you're a pitcher in AAA and they call you up and go, no, I'm not ready. It's like, this is your shot at the major leagues. You've got to say yes and go do it, you know?
Oh, I have a lot of problems. I have that problem where sometimes in the middle of the night, I'll stop breathing. And it's not sleep apnea. It's the other one where your wife's holding a pillow over your face.
I love the baseball references. And since you brought that up, are you a big fan?
I am, actually. You know, my son played in a couple independent leagues. He played professional baseball for a couple of years.
Wow.
And it was so much fun watching him. And he, you know, he played in Billings, Montana. He played in Kokomo, Indiana. He played in Trinidad, Colorado. And he played in Salem, Oregon. You know, he played in all these different places. And it was, oh, my God, it was so much fun.
Oh, yeah. Some of the minor league team names are hilarious, too.
Oh, love them. Love them. Yeah. He was on the Trinidad Triggers. That stuff was really so much fun.
So I'm going to ask you, because you are from Boston, you can see over my shoulder over here as to who my team is, perhaps.
Oh, my gosh.
So we can still be friends, right? Well, Hawaii is not exactly a hotbed of professional sports. So I'm guessing you're a Boston Red Sox fan.
I am. But I have to say, it's so funny where, you know, we lived in New York for a long time and I have so many comic friends. I have so many friends who are Yankee fans. And I remember when they were playing the Rangers a few years ago in the playoffs, and I'm rooting all I can for the Rangers, even though at the time I couldn't name a single friend of mine who was a Rangers fan.
Yeah,
and I'm rooting against 100 of my friends, you know.
Of course, now that I'm a dad, I'll call my dad, ask for advice. He always says the same thing. How'd you get this number?
But yeah.
Wow. Well, if you're a baseball fan, or at least someone who appreciates that, when I was just a little teeny kid, when I was still in New York, because that's where I was born, I got to meet Mickey Mantle. I got to pat him on the back. And that
oh,
was
my God.
Touching God.
Oh, my God. That's really fantastic.
Yeah.
Wow. That's great. And that's, I do think there's also your childhood heroes. That never goes away. You know, you're just in awe of them. I can't imagine. That's fantastic.
I know. Isn't that something it's so wild. And back in the day, you know, when we were young kids, it's like you wanted to be a baseball player. You wanted to be a fireman. You wanted to be an astronaut. There weren't a lot of us out there who wanted to be comedians. So that's why I love speaking to people like you, because I'm guessing that that was deep down inside of you.
We always call my grandfather Poppy. Because of his opium.
It was. I mean, don't get me wrong. I wanted to be a baseball player and all that stuff as a little kid. But I think around 10 or 11, you got to go, I don't know that's going to happen. Reality starts to set in. But what happened to me was I always loved jokes and I loved comedy. And when I would watch the Dick Van Dyke Show, I realized, there is such a thing as being a comedy writer. That can be a job. You know, when I was a little kid, there really weren't comedy clubs that I knew of. And I didn't know how people became comedians. But what happened is there'd be a comedian on like Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin in the afternoon. And my mother would call me in from playing outside and say, Brian, there's a comedian. I'd come in and I'd watch the comedian. And then I'd go back out and play wiffle ball with my friends or whatever. That was always in there. You know, I would say a comedy nerd from an early age. And it's funny, when we would talk in the writers' room at Conan about when we were kids, we were all comedy nerds when we were little, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. How could you not be? You know, Merv Griffin, yeah, I'm glad you brought him up, because he was quite an eccentric fellow, wasn't he?
He was. And I never got to meet him or anything like that. But I was so appreciative that they actually had comedians on during the day like that. That was a real treat, you know?
Merv used to crack me up. Of course, I was a young kid too, watching him, but the way he would always want to show us your lining inside of his jacket, like that was his big deal.
Because
men wore coats, right? And so the lining was apparently his holy grail.
And to try to explain that to a young person now, they wouldn't know what you're talking about yet.
Oh, yeah. You can't even have a young person take a rotary phone and show you how to dial it, right? Speaking of young people, what are your kids' ages?
My kids are 28 and 26.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So they're younger in my act.
My wife did that Ancestry.com. She discovered that one of her ancestors graduated in the first graduating class at Harvard in 1636. And get this, 2 weeks ago, he finished paying off his student loans.
It's funnier with their teenagers, but my son is in law school now, and my daughter works in New York. Yeah.
Wow. Do you get a lot of material from them now?
Oh, yeah.
Their world?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And my favorite time of my life was when my kids were little, and it was so much fun doing all that stuff. And also making your kids laugh is the greatest thing in the world. Oh,
I bet. Do you have any advice for aspiring comics? What advice might you give somebody who is thinking about doing that and asked you for a little bit of like points or tips?
My wife is a psychology major in college, so she's constantly psychoanalyzing me. When I wanted to fire the pool boy, she said, "You feel threatened by young virile males because you're getting older and you're coping with your own mortality." And my argument was, we don't have a pool. What is Enrique doing here?
Well, you know, my friend Laurie Kilmartin, who I worked with at Conan, she always tells people, do it every night for 10 years and you'll be good. People don't want to hear that. People want to be good in 6 months. They want to, you know, they want to. It is that kind of that Malcolm Gladwell thing about putting your 10,000 hours in.
Yeah.
And also, not everybody's life lends themselves to, you know, I met some woman who, she had like 5 kids under the age of 6. And she's like, well, I want to start doing this. It's like, you can't go on the road. You can't do all these things. You don't need to be the struggling artist that is starving or whatever.
Notice that so many people have gotten into the podcast world in these past, I guess, post-COVID years, that is just getting pretty crazy out there, which leads me to my next question about the future of funny. Where is it? What is it? Is there AI involved with it? Is it going to exist? Is it going to grow?
I grew up in a very religious family, but my best friend now is atheist. He said to me, how can you believe God exists when you've never seen him? I said, well, I believe Home Depot employees exist.
I hope AI doesn't get involved. That kind of scares me. But I think the trend that it's going is, I think there's less appealing to a general audience and more to people seem to be kind of finding their demographic. And I think the downside is there's sometimes when I'd see a comedian and they come on, like everyone knows who they are. And I'm like, I haven't heard of this guy. You know what I mean? And I'm not part of the club, so I don't know what's happening here. I do think it's nice in the terms of a lot of different voices can be heard. Really, whatever demographic of old and young and whatever your ethnicity is and your gender is and all that stuff, I think you can find people that you're relating to. Mm-hmm. You know, they used to be like people would kind of go on Johnny Carson and that was kind of the way it became famous. I don't know how people become famous now. Right. You know, it's, you know, people, there are young people that they build up a huge following on TikTok or something and they get, I never heard of them, you know, and they've got 5 million followers and they're huge. And I'm like, I think I'm in comedy, never heard of them. So
I know that's funny. A friend of mine was telling me about Mr. Beast. And up until a year ago, I had never even heard of the guy. And, you know, apparently he's the biggest thing in the world on YouTube, getting 156 million views on his videos.
Yeah, I don't know who that is.
Oh, you're not familiar with him either. Well, thank you.
No. And it's funny where there are times when my kids will bring up somebody and I'm like, who is that? Who is right. that? So if you find out the path to success, let me know, because I'd like to get in on that. You know?
Yeah, I think we're doing it now, or at least being able to have the opportunity to do it now by looking at each other from thousands of miles away. And I think that's part of the whole marketing effort that may be useful for a lot of folks in the future.
I watch a lot of sports. I like reading history books and I like reading well-written novels. And I do a thing where I like to go down a Wikipedia rabbit hole every day for about 10 minutes. Uh-huh. And just pick some random subject and learn about it and go, oh, that's interesting. And things that I wouldn't normally stumble upon. There's so much with the internet that you can just find so many interesting things out there, you know?
I was a little kid when my grandfather died. I remember I asked my mother, I said, when I die, will I see Grampy again? And she said, not if you're good.
And even, you know, on Instagram, these reels pop up. I get these baby elephant videos that pop up on Instagram. I didn't even know I liked baby elephant videos, but apparently the algorithm figured out that I do. I see them every day. They're hilarious and cute. It's like, well, I don't know how you knew that, but you got me, you know?
Well, the great algorithm found your desire.
It did.
Oh, that's the rest of us get kitty cat videos, right?
Oh, there you go. All right. Whatever it is, the little elephants, I'm hooked.
Oh, that's so funny. That is so funny. Can you tell us a little bit about how people can follow you and start to watch you? And
Sure. Well, it's funny. So I'm on Twitter or X or whatever it is now, and I've moved over to Threads, but I still have to do Twitter because most of my followers are on Twitter, and I have such a small following on Threads. So I'm at Kylie Noodles on Twitter, and then it's Kylie Brian Comic on Instagram. And then also my website, you can just go to briankylie.com.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you've got a good following, and you have a few different sites that people can look at and kind of follow you right now.
Yeah, I do. You know, I like to tweet a joke every day. It's a good discipline for me to sit in the morning and I always try to write 5 jokes the first thing, and I'll tweet one of those. And then on Instagram, I'm trying to create the illusion that things are going well. So I'll put stuff on that of my career and maybe once a week or so.
Is a written joke somehow lost in translation versus a joke that you tell to someone face to face?
Well, it depends on the joke. They're definitely... And there's some jokes. That's what's interesting to me about Twitter is you can have a joke that kills on Twitter and it gets thousands of people like it. And then on stage, it lays flat. Uh-huh. And vice versa. And then sometimes there's a joke that works on both. So it's so sort of specific to that thing. But there are some jokes that are better as a written joke. And it's, but you see it in print and it's funny, but it's not funny verbally for some reason, or it's too much of a thinker or something, you know?
Yeah.
And there's some jokes, it needs the inflection, it needs the facial expression, it needs the timing and all that, you know?
Right. And that's something that you specialize in, definitely.
Oh, well, thanks. I think it's years of, you do learn a lot from bombing.
Brian, how do you feel for 2024? Are you optimistic or do you think stuff's going to just keep spinning out of control?
This is a tough time right now, isn't it? You know, and... It's a very divisive time, and I'm kind of dreading this presidential election because it's just going to be so acrimonious, and it's very hard to really be excited about anybody and that, you know. So yeah, I'm and I have to say I am, you know, I used to be immersed in the news every day. You go to work at Conan and you're looking at premises, you're looking at all the websites, you're looking at all the different things. Now that I'm not doing that, I really stay away from the news because I don't want to be, it's almost like I got too much and I need a little break from it, you know, but no, I will say this. There's a lot of sort of millennial bashing or Gen Z bashing or whatever. And when I talk to my kids and their friends and whatever, I'm really impressed with so many young people. I am optimistic in terms of what they're going to do with the world. Mm-hmm. I'm not optimistic about these two elderly guys running for president in 2024. You know?
Yeah, yeah, that's not the buffet you want to belly up to, for sure.
Yes, that's yeah absolutely.
No, it's after watching Oppenheimer last night, I was in need of a little bit of optimism. So, you know, it's just a difficult world right now.
Oh my God, it really is. It really is. But I think when we get through this, and I think things will get better eventually again, you know?
Oh, fantastic. Well, good news. Brian Kiely, it's been just such an amazing experience to sit down and spend time. Thank you for your generosity in making time to be here.
Well, it's been so much fun talking to you. This is, I love, you know, I love this stuff, so.
Well, you're good at it. Have a great rest of 24. We'll be in touch, and we'll stay plugged in. Continued success.
Yes, yes. We'll keep in touch. I hope to talk to you soon.
Well, that was great. Thank you so much. That was a lot of fun.
It was really fun. That went by so fast. I don't even know how long we were talking, but I love talking comedy, and it's you're fun to talk to, and it's just, that was great. It's really great.
It was just so serendipitous to have found you when I was just kind of doing the YouTube thing. The way that you go down the Wikipedia, sometimes I'll just do the YouTube and I'll get away from the algorithm and I won't log in and I'll just see what it brings me. And then there you were. And it was a good thumbnail. I think it was entitled something like The Best One-Liners or something. I said, I got to watch this because I remember Rodney and
oh, I loved Rodney.
And Henny
oh my God.
Youngman. And those were the guys who I guess we grew up with, right? So I was thinking, oh, if this guy can bring me a couple of laughs, I'm totally in the mood. I'm ready for it.
Good, good. I'm glad the algorithm or the thing did it, whatever, the universe did it, whatever.
And I know, and I think as soon as we say aloha today, I'm going to start seeing baby elephant.
Well, you're welcome.
Take care, my friend. We will be in, we'll be in touch.
All right, Matthew, thank you so much. That was so much fun.
Thanks, Brian.
Bye. You guys have been so much fun. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.